give to you today the order of events. Our first item is going to be Senate Bill 347, followed by Senate Bill 1031, Senate Bill 1201, Senate Bill 1062, Senate Bill 512, and Senate Bill 430. And we'll now open a public hearing on Senate Bill 347. And we'll call up Alan Sharn, DPSST. Welcome.
Chair, can I join him?
Feel free, Ken. Sure. All right, welcome.
Thank you very much. Chair Wilson and members of the committee, I am Alan Sharn, Deputy Director of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, DPSST. I'm here today to provide information regarding Senate Bill 347 on behalf of the Department and the Board on Public Safety Standards and Training, DPSST. During the 1993 legislative session, the Oregon Fire Standards and Accreditation Board was transferred from the Office of the State Marshal and merged with the Board on Public Safety Standards and Training, DPSST. Part of this transfer included DPSST being given responsibility for fire protection equipment. An oversight resulted in this definition being transferred that was intended to stay with the State Fire Marshal's office. Neither DPSST nor DPSST have a role in establishment of fire protection equipment standards. This is a function that has remained with the State Fire Marshal's office. This legislation would simply delete the definition of fire protection equipment from statutes relating to DPSST, and it keeps it with the Fire Marshal's office where it was intended to be all along. The second issue addressed by this legislation is an expansion of the definition of fire service professional for the purposes of training and certification. The Office of Legislative Counsel brought this issue to our attention. The current definition has the possibility of being interpreted as restrictive toward volunteer firefighters. This was not the intent of the original definition, and this proposed legislative change would correct this issue. This legislation has no fiscal impact, and to our knowledge, there is no opposition to this legislation. I would be happy to answer any questions at this time.
Representative Atkinson.
It'll still be covered by the fire marshal, is that right?
I'm sorry?
By deleting this here under public safety and standards and training, it'll still be covered by the fire marshal, is that correct?
Chair Atkinson and, Representative Atkinson and Chair Wilson, yes, the definition of fire protection equipment is still covered under the state fire marshal.
I might ask just a bit about the role of the volunteer firefighter in relationship to what you want to do here. Why are we doing that?
The legislative council, first of all, approximately 80% of the fire service professionals in Oregon are volunteer, 20% are paid full-time. We have always certified both of those folks voluntarily at this point. When the Legislative Council was preparing this bill and read the definition for fire service professional, it was their opinion only that the definition could be interpreted to not include the volunteers, which would exclude them from voluntary certification, which is what we do now. So that was why those few words were changed in the bill, or the proposed changes are being made in the bill that says paid or volunteer firefighter, just to clarify that.
What is the purpose of certification, and especially if it's voluntary?
The purpose of the certification is to maintain standards throughout the state and to make sure that each fire service professional and each fire service department is maintaining the same standard.
Okay. Let me ask about on any department, you would have a mix of those who are certified and those who are not, I presume. Is that correct? And if so, is that a problem with those departments?
Chair Wilson, that is correct, although there are many departments that are completely volunteer. And to the best of my knowledge, there's no opposition to this. There's no problem with that. A lot of the volunteers and the full-time staff now are striving for certification, and a lot of them do it. It's all voluntary at this point, but they want the, a lot of them want the certification.
All right, thank you. Any further questions?
Mr. Chair, will you entertain a motion?
Well, I would certainly do that. Yes, we will have to go into a work session. Ken, is there anything you want to say?
Not a thing.
You shouldn't.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I wanted to give you that opportunity. All right, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 347, and we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 347.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Bowman.
I move Senate Bill 347 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Bowman moves Senate Bill 347 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none. Clerk, would you call the roll?
Atkinson?
Aye.
Beck?
Aye.
Bowman?
Aye.
Deckard?
Aye.
Harper?
Aye.
Dodd?
Aye.
Simperi?
Aye.
Thompson? Wilson?
Aye. And the
order,
motion carries. And
Beck.
Beck.
I'll take that. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 347. Now we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1031. And Kara, would you explain to us briefly what 1031 pertains to?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I find my file. Senate Bill 1031 would give Metropolitan Service Districts the authority to make minor boundary changes. And this was at the request of Metro. Where is Metro?
Thank you.
Mr. Phelps.
All right, we'll have Ray Phelps up first, please.
Also, members, if you don't have one, I have them. There is a proposed -1 amendment from the Oregon Building Industry Association that would add an emergency clause to the bill. If you don't have it, let me know.
All right. Thank you. And Mr. Phelps, please.
Thank you.
No,
good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Ray Phelps, and I'm representing Metro. Senate Bill 1031 was introduced at the request of Metro. The 69th Legislative Session, the Legislative Assembly, abolished the Portland Metropolitan Area Boundary Commission. The authority to make decisions regarding changes to the metro boundary now rests with Multnomah County Commission. That's Chapter 516, Oregon Laws, 1997. Metro has determined there is a need to expand its boundary in certain lands located in Clackamas, Washington County, in order to carry out its responsibility under Oregon laws regarding Metro's urban growth boundary. Prior to moving the boundary, however, the land must be annexed to Metro at the request of the majority of the owners and electors residing on the land. Clackamas, Multnomah, and Washington counties all agree that the elected Metro Council should make the annexation decisions affecting Metro's boundary. Senate Bill 1031 would amend Oregon law to allow for this result. We request the committee act favorably on this measure today. We know of no opposition. With me is Mr. Ross, and he has a request of the committee which we feel is appropriate.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Kelly Ross, representing the Home Builders Association of Metropolitan Portland. We have come before you today to request an emergency clause to be added to this bill because after the bill left the Senate, the first batch of boundary amendments went before the Multnomah County Board of Commissioners, who is charged with jurisdiction over this. And frankly, they were overwhelmed by the matter before them, a huge stack of documents that had been generated over a number of years, many years, and tabled the matter before them. That's important because under the Metro Code, there's a six-month deadline to get these boundary changes made and finalized after the council first adopts a resolution on that. We're coming up very quickly on that six-month deadline, which falls on June 17th, and it is our hope that we could get this legislation effective before that date and allow the Metro Council to proceed with the work that they've been working on for so long and with so much input from the public.
Thank you. Any questions?
Chair?
Representative Beck.
Thanks. Mr. Ross, can you describe the, maybe give an example of sort of boundary, what sort of things were tabled and types of boundary changes are we talking about?
Well, last, Mr. Chairman, Representative Beck, last December, when the council made the decision to expand the urban growth boundary to comply with the statutes on the timeline for that, part of the land that they approved was actually outside Metro's boundary, and they adopted a resolution to approve that land, but it would be subject to the annexation boundary change process. There's a number of parcels in Washington County, I believe some in Clackamas County, which are outside the scope and knowledge of the Multnomah County Board of Commissioners. I think also part of their reluctance in approving this is just a discomfort with acting on land that's outside their county boundaries for which they have very little knowledge, and that was also part of the reason I think that they were tabled.
Follow up. Go ahead. This doesn't relate to the urban growth boundary. This is the metro district boundary.
Correct.
What you described, the decision in December was the urban growth boundary expansion, correct?
That was the decision that actually gave rise to the conclusion by the Metro Council that they needed to also expand their district boundary
to reflect the urban growth boundary.
Right,
expansion.
Right.
Is any of the urban growth boundary / district boundary expansions in areas that are now under appeal?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Beck, yes, they are.
So would it be, Mr. Chair, would it be premature to expand maybe Mr. Phelps, this is more directed to you, would it be appropriate for Metro to be expanding the district boundary when part of the agency's decision is under some kind of court appeal? Maybe the emergency clause is premature at this point.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beck, to my knowledge, the only areas that can be in it are those areas that have the approval of the majority of the owners and electors of the land. So we would not be moving anything into the boundary that doesn't have that approval.
I'm done.
All right.
All right. Well, gentlemen, thank you very much. Appreciate that. All right, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1031, and we will open a work session on Senate Bill 1031.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bowman.
I move Senate Bill 1031 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Do we want to deal with the amendments?
As conceptually amended.
We have amendments.
We do have.
We have.
So would you like to move the dash one?
Yes. Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendment.
All right. Representative Bowman moves the dash one amendments into Senate Bill 1031. Is there any discussion? Any objection?
I'm going to object to the dash one amendments.
All right. Noting an objection?
No, I just can say something.
One objection noted, and dash one's adopted.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Bowman.
I move Senate Bill 1031 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Bowman moves Senate Bill 1031 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Representative Deckard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to say to my colleagues on the committee that this would be helpful to my district in Beaverton. We have these issues that arise, and it's helpful for legislation.
Thank you for the discussion.
Can't talk out of this, though? Yeah. Keep going, Deckard. I like it.
The best bills of the session.
Oh, keep talking. Yeah.
Okay, that's best bills. I'm confused now. Yes.
Beck.
Aye.
Bowman.
Yes.
Deckard.
Aye.
Hartford.
Aye.
Starr.
Aye.
Sinceri.
Okay, aye.
Thompson.
Aye. And motion carries. And, Representative Deckard, it seems appropriate that you might carry that.
Thank you.
Right. Thank you. And we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 1031, and we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1201. We have our witness list here in just a moment.
Mr. Chair, members, well, these folks are coming up. There's a dash A2 amendment. It should be at your place. Make sure you have it.
I do check and make sure you've got the dash 2 there, please. And Kara, would you take a moment to explain the bill to us, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Would revise the local budget law statute. I noticed the SMS I sent you says nothing about what the bill does. Apologize. We'll get a new one soon. Pretty long bill, and I think they have some handouts that are color-coded to aid your understanding of the bill.
All right, sounds good. On the witness list, Lance Colley, City of Roseburg, Linda Berglehaus, and Dave Hoyer. Am I presuming that we're okay there?
Yes, we are.
All right, welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lance Colley from the City of Roseburg. The three of us are here representing the Oregon Municipal Finance Officers Association, who have prepared this bill. To give you a very brief history, during the last legislative session, we rewrote local budget law for the first time in approximately 30 years. We represent a group of financial professionals from cities, counties, ports, special districts. We have associate members from school districts, bond counsel, financial professionals in the banking industry. After our last bill was passed, Measure 50 was passed. Included in this bill are some technical corrections that allow us now to bring local budget law back in compliance with Measure 50. We have handed out a color-coded description of the amendments to this law. Primarily, we're dealing with technical issues. We do have a couple of policy issues that Dave Boyer will speak on, and we also have included in this bill some legislative changes relating to TSCC, which Linda will be happy to discuss with you. So,
before we go further, could I ask you to bring us up to speed on what local budget law really is, what this body of law is and what it is designed to do, and who uses it?
Local budget law is used by every municipal entity in the state of Oregon. We are required to follow certain procedures and processes, which include budget committees at the local level to provide for local input. It requires us to publish information in one of a number of ways to ensure that our communities have appropriate information to participate in the decision-making process at the local level. It ultimately requires us to adopt appropriations, which are absolute spending limits, and allows for a public process.
Thank you.
Yes, my name is Linda Berglehaus, and I represent the Tax Supervisor and Conservation Commission, which is a five-member governor-appointed commission that was established in 1919 by the legislature, and we operate in Multnomah County. And we oversee all of the budgeting for property tax entities in the Multnomah County. Currently, that is about 36 entities. And you're going to see some changes in here that are in the magenta color that relate specifically to the process that we follow. We actually go through every budget in detail. The commissioners actually hold the hearings for some of these entities. And the main piece that we have in here is a $50,000 increase in our budget to be funded by Multnomah County. The Multnomah County has to fund the commission. The legislature sets the dollar amount that they're funded with. And we do have the support of the Multnomah County Commissioners. You've received a letter in support of this. They are in agreement with that funding increase. And all of the changes for the tax supervising that relate to them have been gone through with each of the entities we represent.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Dave Boyer, Finance Director of Multnomah County, also a member of the committee that put together these changes in local budget law for the Oregon Municipal Finance Officers Association. Included in the green are, under the green, are some policy changes, and I'll just hit on the two major policy changes. One of them, section 12-6, on page 2, allows local governments to retroactively make budget modifications on pass-through monies only. And I'll give you a specific example of what I'm talking about. Multnomah County imposes a hotel tax, and then we pass that money on by contract to Metro. So if the hotel-motel tax comes in a little bit higher than we budget, under contract, we are required to pay that to Metro. If we get more money in, we're required to pass it on, and that gives us a budget violation because we've gone over our appropriation. If we don't pass it on to Metro, we are in a contract violation. And so this would allow this to be approved by the governing body after the fact, but it's only on pass-through monies. This is a specific revenue source of pass-through monies only. And this then would allow us not to have a budget violation. It pertains to all districts. City of Roseburg, Lance has said that they had a budget violation comment for $324 on the same type of issue, and this would eliminate a budget violation there. The other item that we're looking for is section 13, and also on page 2, and this would allow for governments, local governments, to have interfund loans. And I'll give you an example of this. If you're in a situation where you need to buy a fire truck, they cost about $250,000, $300,000, it makes more sense if you have reserves like in a self-insurance fund or some other type of a fund that you have the money that you borrow internally for a three-year period instead of going outside. And what you do by that is you eliminate all the bond counsel costs, your rating agency costs. You eliminate a lot of costs of going outside when you can do it internally. You'd have to do this by resolution. You'd have to go before your governing body. You'd have to set an interest rate. You'd have to have a payment schedule to pay it back. Everything you would as if you were going outside to borrow money, and it would be for capital only. It would not be for operational items at all. And this would eliminate the need to go outside, and there are built-in limits because it makes more sense once you get about to $2 million. It makes more sense to borrow money from outside than internally. And those are the two major policy changes.
Thank you, Representative Atkinson.
How much money do you have available for interfund loans?
Chair Wilson, Representative Atkinson, in our self-insurance fund for Multnomah County, it's going to vary by district, but Multnomah County, we have about $17 million that we need to keep in our self-insurance fund as reserves for our liabilities. They're called incurred but not reported claims. You have the cash in the insurance fund, but you need to keep that cash on to pay off all your workers' comp, your tort liabilities, everything that you don't have, you've incurred, but you don't have to pay it out. You'll be paying it out over time. So you may have that for 10 years, and what we're saying is it would make sense, instead of going outside and incurring bond counsel expenses, underwriter expenses, if we could borrow it internally and pay ourselves back.
Go ahead.
Aren't you damaging, though, if you have that insurance rating? Aren't you jeopardizing that insurance rating by loaning against yourself?
Chair Wilson, Representative Atkinson, not really, because you'd set up as a balance sheet receivable and a payable between the two loans. So you're still not damaging it because it's just a cash flow item. It's not a it's not an expenditure item because you've already recorded that expenditure. It's, I guess you can relate it to like an insurance company, an outside insurance company. They don't hold on to their money. They also loan it out and do things. So it'd be similar to that.
Okay. Well, right now, line 3 of this explanation says currently 1-year interfund loans are permitted for operating purposes. So just catch me up to speed. If you're making an accounting correction for operating expenditures, right? I mean, is that what you currently can do? You're just moving labor from one side, for AR, AP, you're just moving numbers around on a balance sheet for 1 year, is that correct?
Chair Wilson, Representative Atkinson. This is, you're not really moving them around on that one, line three. That is current practice. Right now, local governments can do operational loans for 1 year. That is in the budget law now. So
right.
We're not changing that.
Well, I know, but I mean, under current practice, isn't that basically, aren't you saying that the accounting principles under the current practice are going to be the same for a five-year capital investment?
They would be the same, only you have to repay it. What we're doing is allowing this for an extra 5 years for capital only to reduce costs of local governments, make ourselves more efficient.
I understand. I'm sorry. I have my business hat on for a minute.
Excuse me. Wait.
Do you have a follow-up?
I will let that go.
All right. Any other questions?
Yeah. Violation of the land use law.
Anything more to add? Any other sections that you'd like to comment on?
You just have the one. Linda Bergelhoff. Chair Wilson, we do have that one amendment that was a section that was just being moved from one ORS to another ORS, and one word inadvertently got changed, and so we want it to be what the original language was. So.
Okay. Very good. Representative Starr, did you have something to add to this?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Colleagues, we also, I also am working on an amendment to this bill that we don't have yet. We should have when we next meet, hopefully. It deals with a budget law as far as school districts, and it will deal specifically with a school district in my district. And when we get that, I guess at that point I can go into detail about what that does. So it's just forewarning, there will be additional amendment.
Okay.
We're also working with proponents of the bill and make sure that everything will work out.
All right. Any further questions from the committee on any of the sections here? All right, well, seeing none, we will close the public hearing then on Senate Bill 1201, and we'll be bringing this back to work session as soon as Representative Starr's amendments are crafted. All right, we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1062, and we'll have our committee administrator bring us up to speed on 1062 as our witnesses come forward.
Yeah, he deserves it.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. This would allow Metropolitan Service Districts to acquire conservation and highway scenic preservation easements.
This
is not Representative Bechtel, but he probably knows something about it.
All right, joining us again is Mr. Phelps. Good afternoon again.
Good afternoon, sir. My name is Ray Phelps. I'm representing Metro. Senate Bill 1062 was introduced at the request of the Metro Council. This bill is a housekeeping measure and would add Metropolitan Service Districts to the list of governmental bodies authorized to acquire conservation and highway scenic preservation easements. Approval of this legislation would grant Metro the same rights that cities, counties, and states currently have to accept conservation and scenic easements. At the time of the original legislation authorizing cities, counties, and states, Metro was not engaged in open space preservation. Subsequent to the passage of the 1995 open spaces bond measure for a total of $135.6 million, Metro has acquired over 4,000 acres of open space from willing sellers. This bond measure was approved by 62% of the voters living in the Metro region. A conservation easement is a particularly effective tool to promote both landowner rights and natural resource protection. It allows a landowner to maintain ownership and receive the market value for the easement while preserving natural resources for future operations. The ability to accept conservation easements would greatly assist landowners and help Metro implement the will of the voters who overwhelmingly passed the bond measure. We request the committee act favorably on this measure, and we know of no opposition to this bill. There was no opposition in the Senate.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? All right. Seeing none, we'll close the work session. The public hearing on 1062. And we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 1062.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Atkinson.
I'd like to move Senate Bill 1062 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Atkinson moves Senate Bill 1062 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Right. Clerk, call the roll, please.
Atkinson?
Aye.
Beck?
Aye.
Bowman?
Yes.
Deckard?
Yes.
Harper?
Aye.
Starr?
Aye.
Vinatieri?
Yes.
Thompson? Wilson?
Aye. And the motion carries.
Aye.
And,
Representative Atkinson, are you there?
Certainly. I appreciate that very much. Thank you. All right, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 1062, and we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 512.
Look at everybody, just some joy out there. It's coming alive.
My goodness.
Everybody.
All right, we have somewhat of a witness sheet here today. Let's go ahead and... Is Representative Gardner here?
We just... Mr. Chair, we just called Representative Gardner and he has been to let them know.
Okay.
So they should be arriving shortly. Ray, do you want to go without them? Members, while Mr. Phelps is coming up, this measure has a subsequent referral to waive me.
Send it to them.
Welcome again.
You know, we refer this to waive the names.
They don't have anything to do.
Why does it go to waive the names?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm expecting the representatives here shortly, but I think I can pick off. We have provided you with printed materials dealing with this bill. And just to give you a little background, we're talking about building codes. The 1973 Legislative Assembly established a policy that there should be only one building code standard in Oregon. The policy was enacted after hearing from the construction business community that building code requirements were different in nearly every jurisdiction where a contractor was working. And the legislature agreed, so in 73 you had this uniform building code. In 1997, the 69th session of the legislature created a task force. Representative Gardner, who will be here in a few minutes, was instrumental in having that legislation adopted. The legislature in that task force assignment told the task force to examine activities related to the administration of the Uniform Building Code Program for streamlining, simplification, and clarification of current administrative procedures. The expenses of this task force were privately funded. The private funds came from business and union organizations and non-union organizations, business owners, and those organizations representing the thousands of the men and the women who work in the construction industry every day. The House approved House Bill 3290, creating the task force. Nearly all of the members of the 70th Legislative Assembly voted to create the task force. Six of you who sit on this committee voted for the task force, and the other three members were not did not serve in the 69th session. Senate Bill 512 is a work product of this task force. It was adopted by the task force with a vote of 9-5. And I'm going to stop talking now while the two important folks, and I'll come back.
All right. Representative Gardner, welcome, and Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dan Gardner, State Representative from House District 13. Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, members, I'd like to give you just a little bit of history of my involvement in this issue. In the 97th session, I sponsored House Bill 3290, which created a task force, and all but two members of the 69th Legislative Assembly voted for the creation of that task force. Senate Bill 512 is a result of that task force. I attended most of the 13 meetings of the task force, and I wish to commend all the members of the task force for the long hours and the hard work that they put in. And a majority of that task force members were from local government. Membership of the Tri-County Service Center is set up in this bill very similar to what the task force was set up to be in the original House Bill 3290. The task force measure was approved by a majority of that body, and this bill, Senate Bill 512, accomplishes all the goals that were talked about and set out in that task force. I just wanted to emphasize that the Tri-County Service Center does not create another layer of bureaucracy. It's a regional operation of the Building Codes Division, And in 1973, the state decided to have one administrative building codes, minister of building codes being VCD. This bill serves to reinforce the notion that of the one building code administration and just emphasize that there was a lot of hard work put in on this, and I think it's an excellent effort, and urge your passage of the bill.
Thank you. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Chair Wilson. I had the pleasure to serve on the task force while I was still involved in Multnomah County. I think the bill and the task force, I think, worked well. I probably attended maybe 8 or 9 of the 13 meetings. A couple of the kind of the big picture things that I think this addresses. The economy has got a lot more complex, a lot more over the years. We've went from to a national building code. Currently, we've got it's almost international in terms of plumbing projects are designed by mechanical engineers that may be operating out of Texas. The contractors maybe are much more national. The industry and government has responded by making national codes, trying to use national analyzation of materials, national analyzation of methods. We've waived a lot of the peculiarities of Oregon code in order to get to the national standardization. On the very local level, though, we still have different interpretations that range from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. And in an area as complicated as the Portland metropolitan area, those can be very expensive. Those different interpretations can be very expensive and time-consuming to contractors that are working in multiple jurisdictions. This can help with that problem. I think the other one is if the Oregon economy is going to blossom and grow and be competitive, we have to have very fast timelines, especially on the new emerging industries. Anything that we can do to streamline that system and make decisions consistent, speed the process of getting permits, plan review, anything along that line that can help some of these emerging businesses get online quicker, get their plants that are probably almost obsolete the day they're built, but get them online as fast as possible. It's going to be a tremendous benefit to the Oregon economy, and this is what the task force was really trying to gear itself towards, and I think we produce results that will get us there.
Thank you. Questions, Representative?
Anybody? Nope.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hansen, you served on the task force. The outline is that's laid out in the Senate bill, is that in fact from the task force work, the work that's been done during the interim?
Yes, it is. Representative Harper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Why is this just a metro problem?
Mr. Chair, if I may, Representative Harper, about 50% of the construction takes place, you know, across the state, takes place in the Tri-County area in Multnomah, Washington, Clackamas counties. There are 26 different jurisdictions that currently do partial or full programs of building codes enforcement in the Tri-County area. And of those, I mean, as one who's worked in the industry, it's very difficult sometimes even to establish, given an address, which jurisdiction you're in when you get close to the lines. That makes it, you know, it makes it very helpful in the industry to do things like a uniform application form for an electrical, plumbing, or building permit. You know, for instance, if you live in Portland, you work in Gresham, and you wish to expand your garage, why can't you go, you know, to the building codes division to the agency in Portland, fill out that application form, you know, where you work at for the place in Gresham, and do an intergovernmental transfer. It's basically that there's a tri-county area that has most of the construction work taking place in it in a small geographic area.
Can I follow up?
Go ahead.
Yeah, Dan, if this is a problem, it's a problem statewide. Why don't we try and fix it statewide? I mean, if you're a Medford contractor working in Grants Pass, you have the same problem.
and you say half of the work is done outside the metro area, I wonder why we don't think, try and fix it.
This might be,
it's not uniform. Why don't we, can we make it uniform?
It might be a good,
it's too tough to do.
You might be able to look at this as a good pilot project. If this works well in the metro, area, it might have the people in Eugene, Springfield might want to take a look at it, or Medford might want to take a look at some type of a similar process there. And they might want to shape it a little bit differently to meet maybe some different conditions there.
Mr. Chair?
Go ahead.
Representative Harper, sometimes flattery is a sincere form of compliment. Senate Bill 587, authored by Senator Lee Beyer, takes some of the materials that we have in Senate Bill 512 and does call for those to be applied statewide. The authorization under House Bill 3290 limit our examination only to the metro area. So we couldn't get beyond it, but there was enough good idea that other people have seen opportunity. I believe that you're going to be hearing from Mr. Brewer, and there is a thought, you know, something like what we're proposing at 512 might work elsewhere.
Representative Sinceri.
Mr. Chair, thank you. At the cost of $500,000, why do we have to create a new level of government here, or a new layer of government, a new board to do this? Why can't we do this with intergovernment agency agreements rather than create another piece of government that we may or may not need?
Well, if I could, Mr. Chair, first of all, you're not creating another layer of government. That has been one of what I consider a gross misunderstanding. All of the members of the board are not paid any compensation whatsoever. The staffing requirement, which I think is realistic, calls for the State Building Codes Division to staff and to operate a regional office in Portland. The access to the kinds of support and other kinds of activity in Salem, when I was in Salem working for a state agency that had application in 36 different counties, you weren't always as responsive. It got to be a balancing game. The fact is that this is seen as an opportunity to be more responsive. With respect to the other notion about another layer of government, the people who oppose this have also proposed another layer, only it's their layer instead of this layer. So whether or not it's another layer or not, I think it's argumentative. What truly, though, is important is that we keep the 26-year policy of a uniform building code process. This will establish and continue the legislative policy of one building code program. And the state is going to be moved into the Portland area and have a regional office there and be just as responsive as they can be in those three counties where more than half or more of the construction occurs.
Representative Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Concern I have is we directed the set up a task force, and that's not an unusual thing that one legislative assembly would ask to do during an interim. The question I have is, we came out of that task force without a unified voice, without a single vehicle that everyone agreed to, and that's my sense of the good things, I mean, the kinds of good things that can come out of task forces when people agree. If you can comment on that, and then the question is, how close are we, the folks that opposed this process or this proposed bill, how close are we to an agreement?
Mr. Chair, Representative Starr, I guess there's two questions, so I'll answer them in the order given. The task force approved by a 9-5 vote Senate bill, what eventually becomes Senate Bill 512. The difference were in two parts. One, we believe that you should have and continue to have one building code process that the legislature has maintained for 26 years. The proposal on the flip side, which frankly was never fully discussed, is an attempt to fragment the state code process and begin to unravel a uniform system. It doesn't work uniformly now, and we have a host of examples of that as we went through the whole discussion and exploration. And the second objection, I believe, is get at me there. I forgot. Wait a minute. I'll get it. The second objection, which are listed on page 6, is the Business and Consumers Department will continue to do the education. And the people voting no believe this process can be administered more effectively at the local level. And obviously we don't disagree, because the legislation will have that training going on at the local level through the Tri-County Board, which in basic fact is the continuation of the Uniform Building Code applications. With respect to your other question, it seems to me you have a threshold. And the threshold is do we have 100% agreement, or do we have a majority agreement of 9 to 5? And that agreement, that 9 includes two public officials. One is now Representative Gary Hansen, and the other is a representative of the fire districts. So what started out with a public board of 8 persons and 7 private persons returned a report 9 to 5. So the truth of the matter is can we achieve consensus? I don't think so. If intergovernment agreements were workable, where have they been for 26 years? These problems have been there off and on and continue to concur, and we can get into details, throughout the last 26 years. Secondly is intergovernment agreements are voluntary, and that's nice. So what happens? You create another layer of chaos. Some will play and some will not participate in the intergovernment agreement process. So what you have is you'll have another opportunity for chaos or for confusion or for whatever you like to call it. And from year to year, the intergovernment agreement, or from year to next year, whatever, you can't bind the governing body beyond its term of office. And as those terms change, city officials, county officials, those intergovernment agreements are up for grabs again. The one thing that the construction industry needs is they need certainty so that they can do the job for the least cost following the best management practices. And you have testimony from Jeff Perella, who's Associated General Contractors, and you have testimony from Mr. Jim Chapman, who is one of the largest home builders in the state of Oregon. He's probably second or third, and probably in his mind he's first, but he's up there. And he believes that he will be more effective and more efficient if he has certainty, and that certainty comes from uniformity. There are contractors, and I believe there's one here today, who will tell you that they employ 2 people or more half-time, but at least 2 full-time employees, to do nothing but keep track of the differences between the various building code processes in the 32 jurisdictions in the Tri-County area. Now, that is a lot of money. And they believe that this will, in fact, get them to a point where they can become much more cost efficient and effective in their delivery to the customer, because they know what to expect anywhere in that county, given the opportunity this Tri-County Board will present in its uniformity. And I can continue on, but does that answer your question?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, just one follow-up. Would you three support amending the bill to include Yamhill and Columbia County?
I don't wish to take that long walk on that short plank. I don't know how to answer you without getting in trouble.
Thank you, Unic, for the question.
If I could try to answer that. I think philosophically, I think it would probably be a reasonable thing to consider and discuss. I certainly wouldn't want to arbitrarily do that without having an opportunity for those 2 counties to be involved in the discussion. And they weren't as asked for, so that those discussions haven't happened yet. The other thing, if I could also speak a little bit on Representative Starr on your earlier question. Although the task force was divided at the end, there was a lot of concurrence, I think almost total concurrence, in terms of the discussions of what the problems were. We differed on what the final solution should be for the solution, but in terms of what problems were occurring within the industries and where streamlining needed to occur, there was a great deal of concurrence there. So I wouldn't want to have you have an opinion from the final vote that it wasn't a strong task force that did a good job of working together on a lot of issues.
If I may follow one other comment, Mr. Chair. This committee has in its possession House Bill 2971. And I believe if you were to go through there, you would find that there were, in fact, only two differences. One is the structure of a board, and not that there should be a board, but how it's structured. And secondly, the education. And we believe it should stay with the first is responsible for the operations.
I wanted to ask you about the fiscal here for just a moment. In looking at it, 9901, it's got almost $500,000, and 01 to 03, $344,000. I guess the question I would have for you is, what are we as the board of directors, so to speak, giving our constituents for that money? What are the taxpayers getting, and how are the taxpayers going to benefit from this type of financial growth, whether or not you want to argue that it is or is not growing government? What are we delivering them?
But I believe what you're getting is a more efficient system. You're getting a more uniform code enforcement. You're getting a better delivery of services in the minor label area. If you look at the minor label program, the way that currently works, you have minor labels for all the different jurisdictions with a six-month sunset for minor programs. This would be, they could expand that to the full Tri-County area. I think you just get a lot of good consumer effects. You get a uniform building code application process. I think it gets a more streamlined, uniform system within the three counties.
I know that serves the people in the business themselves, but as far as the average individual out there paying taxes who's not involved in the trades, anything like that, what are they getting for it?
Well, they would get additionally a streamlined system. As I said, if one worked in Gresham and lived in Portland or vice versa, pick any of the cities in the Tri-County area, they would get a more efficient system in that manner. They would get a better system all the way around, more uniform enforcement.
Well, a real classic example would be if these are going to be fee-driven charges. So obviously, you got to get $500,000 somewhere, and it's going to be from higher permit fees. The person that pays that additional permit fee, which is probably going to be the customer, is apt to get their building done maybe six weeks sooner, because plan checks will be done on a faster basis. The contractor may not have to be in a dispute for a few days with the building official over a code interpretation. If that build there's going to be a slight increase on the permit, but if the big picture though is if your building that maybe has cost you from $200,000 on up is usable 6 or 8 weeks sooner, the savings would be incredible to the consumer.
Mr. Chair, I'd take a stab at it also. I'll direct your attention to page 2 of my initial testimony. And you'll note that there are 12 private sector organizations listed there supporting this bill. There's two significant things about this list. First of all, it includes any construction organization and or labor representation organization that deals directly in the construction industry. This group typically and traditionally has never liked additional costs and additional bureaucracy, if you will. It is, should be significant to this committee that these organizations are saying, no, this is needed. It's kind of like it's about the only way to fix it. And I'll point out something else to you as well. These private organizations and the people who work for these organizations, the people who belong to these associations, whether they be business owners or workers, are also people who bid. These are construction jobs. These jobs are bid. It's the sharp pencil and it's the number. And what's going to happen, as it does in all cases, you will look at your fixed costs and you will look at your variable costs. And you will consider whether or not those costs will or will not allow you to get this job that you particularly want to have. So you'll begin to go in and start moving that pencil a little quicker and a little sharper. It's our belief that in some cases, and I know contractors who do it now, some of this added cost, this $500,000, will be absorbed in that cost of operation to the construction person, and some of it will go on to the customer, but the customer will have improved service, and that improved service will result in savings of dollars, particularly in the high-tech industry. You have a huge turnover in whether equipment, I can't think of the right word, it's not retirement, it's whether equipment is viable after 12, obsolete, yeah. In the high-tech industry, those kinds of equipments move into obsolescence quickly. The high-tech company can't get up and running quickly, they may as well bother those, may as well not even bother, because by the time they do it, they may be obsolescent on something they never actually got into production, or they got into production with such a short life, they never recovered their initial investment. And those are the kinds of costs that I think can be justified. I'm not one for big government, never have been, but I believe those costs can be justified in the fact that the business person is being in a competitive environment where they have to deliver the best product at the least cost that the customer will pay, and that product has to be delivered when the customer needs it, or that's money also.
All right, thank you. Any further questions? Representative Bowman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question about the fiscal as well. And my question has more to do with, I'm assuming that the individual cities who are currently issuing the permits, they no longer will be involved in that. So they will be freeing up some staff. Is that not right?
That is not correct.
Okay. Then tell me what I am trying to say, please.
Mr. Chair, excuse me for interrupting. I did not mean to do that.
No, that's okay.
Impolite. Excuse me. But what will occur is this is an additional cost. All of the other fees and other kinds of expenses that go into the construction process right now will not be touched. And that brings you to the ability to have an unfunded mandate. This is an unfunded mandate. The reason it's an unfunded mandate is there's an additional fee that's going to be paid to support the Tri-County. And it's under the belief that the Tri-County Service Board will introduce the kinds of efficiencies and economies that will allow this fee increase to actually pay for itself. Mm-hmm. And again, I apologize for interrupting.
Anyone else? All right. Thank you very much.
I have a few more things to talk about.
If you do, would you make it very quickly? Because we have to be out of this room by 3:15. We have another hearing after this.
Oh. Okay, because I was going to go through the bill. I mean, there's a lot of information. I didn't know how you want to do this, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, as a committee, do you want to go through the bill, or what is your
interest? Mr. Chair, are you going to bring this back so that we can...
Yes, it will be back. We're not going to be work session today, so this is not the last opportunity to...
Okay, because there's a number of points that have been being made along the way, but there's a number of other elements that are significant, both for the task force process as well as understanding a lot of the underpinning of what we're introducing and trying to do.
Mr. Chair, possibly he could come back. I mean, they're in the building most of the time. There are people that have traveled here that would like... I'd like to have some of that outside input.
I'm not trying to...
We've got a large sheet of people to talk to today that we want to try to cover today, and we...
I'm tired of listening to them.
I'm out of here.
We're going to bring you back one way or the other. Thank you. All right, next up will be Ray Carriage of City of Portland and Clint Hillman, Oregon Building Officials Association.
That was not nice.
He was doing a couple other committees we've got.
I'm like a kid. Background. Just goes off.
Oh, yeah.
All right. If you'll identify yourselves prior to delivering your testimony, appreciate it.
My name is Clint Hillman. I'm the building official with the City of Gresham. I served on the task force, was at almost every meeting, and participated enthusiastically in the task force and represented the Oregon Building Officials Association. I was their designated representative on the task force. And I come to you with a perspective as prior to becoming the building official, I was a business owner. I operated a construction company was self-employed for several years. So I obtained permits and inspections. I approached this from both sides of the industry. I want to echo the fact that I felt that the task force was very positive. This committee appointed the task force. I came down and testified at an interim meeting to some of the members here and was enthusiastic at that point, and I still am. The items that we came up with in how to resolve the problems, we unanimously agreed on. Everyone agreed on it. So when we got down to how to solve the problem, we did not really have an opportunity to talk about alternatives. And when this was decided, and so I really feel that while we support the work of the task force, and there's many positive things, and that needs to go forward, that this proposed Senate Bill 512 in its current form is not the best and most effective way for that to happen.
Thank you. Are your other two companions going to be able to maybe elaborate on that point? Thank you. Would you identify yourself?
Yeah, Chair Wilson, my name is Ray Kerridge. I'm representing the City of Portland. We, too, were represented on the task force. And as Clint has mentioned, there was a lot of consensus on most, or if not all, of the service-related issues. The consensus broke down at the end when it came to the issue of this oversight board. And I think you heard from the previous speakers there was a vote, and the oversight board came in that way. Portland City Council looked at the bill. They agreed with all of the service-related improvements that were in the bill, but they, too, had a problem with the oversight board. There are a number of problems, but they really can be condensed into two. One of their issues, the first issue, was the unbalanced nature of the board. In other words, they felt that the board should be representative of both government and industry. And the second problem they had was with the sweeping rulemaking authority that the board was given. So on that basis, they decided to oppose the bill, and I believe there were 20 or so other jurisdictions in the metropolitan area that took similar actions. We believe, though, the city believes there's some middle ground here, and we will be willing to look at this bill again if there are a couple of minor amendments or changes, which I just mentioned real briefly. Yeah. If it were possible if there was an amendment to change the balance of the board so that it would be more equal distribution between government and industry, we would certainly support that. And if the rulemaking authority of the board were restricted to the areas outlined in the bill, we could live with that kind of arrangement. The way it is right now, the rulemaking authority is very, very broad, and it could go way, way, way beyond anything that's written within Senate Bill 512. If there was an amendment that would modify that or restrict that authority to cover those service-related areas, then we feel that we could probably support the bill. That's all I had.
All right, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Alan Langendorf, and I'm president of the Oregon Building Officials Association and also building official for the City of Lake Oswego. And I just have a couple of comments regarding the some of the previous speakers' comments and having to do with the board itself. And that, as Ray just indicated, that the board itself and the rulemaking authority is probably the two major stumbling blocks, or at least as far as our concerns are. The code interpretation part of it, the building codes division itself is not uniform in their own interpretation within their own personal staff. How they can assume that a new board is going to create some sort of code interpretation uniformity is still a mystery to us, all of us building officials and code officials. We all are required to do a certain amount of training for our certifications. How this board is going to improve that training process is still a mystery. They want to train within the Tri-County. Is there something so unique about the Tri-County building code that is not uniform? Is there something special about that area that needs to have special training, special board, special everything? Everything that this Senate Bill 512 currently attempts to do is already allowed in rules and law the building codes agency to do. There isn't any reason to, again, create another layer that we assume is going to perhaps write some rules that may be different for Tri-County that are not going to be enforced somewhere else in the state. That means then we would have some inconsistency between one's other counties. So that is obviously a fear for us as building officials for the state. The list of representatives brought up that they were all trade folks. Very important issue that they are certainly the ones that would be impacted by how we interpret the code and the things that we do. None of them are enforcement agencies. And it's interesting that these are the ones that we are the ones that have to work with to enforce the code and the provisions of the code, which we definitely have the ability to do under certain provisions and sections of the code. It allows us to recognize these quick changes in technology. We all have that ability. I believe the proponents believe that somehow this board will shorten the amount of time for code interpretations and allow this to happen much quickly. We're mandated already by the code itself and how we proceed through alternate methods and materials to allow some of these issues to be taken care of. OBOA certainly urges us to do more work in the area of uniformity. We're prepared to do part of that. We would like you to consider the issues that Ray Carriage just brought up about the potential of changing 512 in certain aspects of it. And I thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Harper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're looking at 512 today because apparently you're not uniform in your interpretation. Can you tell me why you're not uniform, why the contractors have all these problems, and you're trying to work with your jurisdictions?
Anybody? Well, that is a difficult issue because the code itself is not exactly black and white. There are ways of interpreting, just as you can read the newspaper article and get one thing out of it, your colleague would sit and get a different interpretation of what that is said. We have different methods of approach of how to inspect for buildings and compliance. So, I repeat, building codes of division themselves are not uniform. You cannot talk to somebody within that division and get the same answer. They try just like any local jurisdiction. Part of the problems, I believe, in the uniformity that they discuss is the uniformity of applications. It doesn't take a Senate Bill 512 to get that kind of uniformity in application. There are rules that BCD certainly passed to require those kinds of things.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
I think that was that's a good example. Simple little form. Why haven't you guys done that simple little form decades ago? Why are we sitting here? But my real question is, how do you get the uniform building code uniform? We have one opinion that we're looking at it, but how do you do that? How would you do it?
Well, education and getting everyone on the same page is one of the methods to get more uniformity. Another one would be a good forum for interpretations to talk to other jurisdictions when you're making an interpretation. Your question is, why hasn't there been more uniformity, more governments working together before this? As I've been in the city of Gresham for 15 years, the city of Gresham is very public service oriented, and we're working hard to serve our customers there, and that's our first priority. And we honestly haven't thought about, you know, the interaction. The task force provided a good forum for us to start talking together and realize this on a global scope. Once that happened, I chaired a committee to look at the forms. We sent a memo out to all the local jurisdictions to send their forms in, and got several representatives from these committees. And in a few weeks, we put together a common permit application that we could all pretty much agree on. So it can happen. Why it didn't happen over the last few years, you know, for one thing, there wasn't the forum and the impetus. Now we've got that. We need to move forward with something to make that happen.
Thank you.
Representative Bowman.
Get one quick one, just on the common things. Common permit, is that in place now?
We haven't put that in place yet. We just, as the, we were nearing the end of the task force work, we just put together the committee, and we have a common form, but we haven't adopted it. We're in, and put it together, because there's no sense in forming a bunch of an IGA and start working if this is going to come along and do the same thing. So, but local governments, the ones that I've dealt with in the metro area, are very interested in public service and want to do things that would be good for the industry.
Just on that point, if I just in thinking about this, it might be helpful to just put it in place. If that's one of the big issues that comes up, of the lack of continuity from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, and how that you've got two people in one company working on some of just this issue or similar issues, that putting those things into place obviously would be, I think, really helpful, in my opinion.
Go ahead. Mr. Chairman, Representative Deckert. The issue of having people chase building permits or permits around from other jurisdictions, quite frankly, most of the jurisdictions, the 27 or 26 or 31, whichever number you can decide on, have methods that it isn't necessary for those people to go from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. In the city of Lake Oswego, we accept fax, email, letter. Those individuals that are doing individual utility permits, as we call them, utility permits being plumbing and electrical and that, don't have to come to our shop. They can do all of this by phone, and we follow up and do that. And most of the jurisdictions have that ability. So that there are some jurisdictions that have not gotten to that point yet. As a matter of fact, I know of one jurisdiction in Columbia County that doesn't have a computer yet. But that is not an issue that can be solved by a tri-county board or any other kind of issue. That is something that's more local. That's something that the jurisdiction itself has to deal with.
Representative Bowman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to go back to one of the first issues that the task force identified, which is the issue of having to buy permit forms in blocks. And if you, and they expire, my understanding is they expire in 6 months. And so if I'm a contractor and I think that I might be doing some work in Gresham, but then I end up actually doing more work in Wood Village or Portland or somewhere else and have to go and buy those blocks of permits there, why should, I mean, if there was one board that had set a policy that said, you know, if you're doing any work in a tri-county, then here's your 10 permits, and as long as you're working in a tri-county, you can use those permits. That sounds like that would be easier for contractors, for the public, and for everybody else. So why is that a bad thing?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bowman, you're talking about the minor label program?
Yes.
And there's absolutely no reason, no problem with having them operating over the metro area. We agree with that. The only reason they work on a local jurisdictional area right now is the way that the state law and state rule is set up. We don't have a problem with it being a metro-wide system at all. In fact, we think it's a good idea.
So you have no problems with anything that they've recommended except the board, yes. The makeup of the board.
And the sweeping rulemaking power that can go beyond the scope of what the service-related items that are outlined in the bill. Those are our only problems.
Is there a specific part of the sweeping rules authority? I mean, is there a part of the bill that says specifically that all of a sudden you've got this sweeping authority?
Yeah. If you read the wording of the bill, Representative Bowman, you can see that it gives the board the power, but it doesn't restrict it in any way. And that's what bothers us, you see, because it's kind of like an open-ended thing. Once there's no end, there's no kind of limits to that authority, and that really gives us the problem. It's the same with giving a local jurisdiction sweeping authority. I think the public would have problems with that because there's no telling, there's no end point in sight, and that concerns us. And
if I may follow up, Mr. Chair, thank you. I heard you say that the makeup of the board, mm-hmm. the unbalance of the makeup of the board is a concern. And what we've also heard is that if it's even local governments and contractors, nothing will happen. and we have a history to prove that nothing happens when it's equal.
Mm-hmm.
Would you care to respond to that?
Representative Omar, I would put a public member in there to have industry representatives, an equal number of industry and government, and have a public member in there to break the tie.
Mr. Chair, one last question. Would you find anybody in the state that would actually want to be that tiebreaker on that board?
Representative, I wouldn't want that position.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Becker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one other question in terms of the two problems that you guys have with Senate Bill 512.
Mm-hmm.
How would that play out in your respective opinions, or just one of you, how would it play out practically in terms of the composition of the board? How might that, for example, play out as a problem? And then the sweeping authority of the board, how that practically would play out?
The problem with, can I take the second point first? The sweeping authority, how would that, if that authority were restricted in the bill to cover all those service-related items that are outlined in the bill, then we wouldn't really have a problem with any way that played out. The problem we have is that, you know, it's just totally, you know, there's no end to it. So I don't know if I'm answering your question, but if
kind of looking for an example of,
yeah,
on both points, here's what could happen.
Yeah.
Our fear is this is what could happen, occur.
Well, let's pull something out of the air. That the board might decide that they wanted to come up with a rule that said, City of Portland, for example, you must complete your plan review on a 40-story office building within 2 weeks. There's no way you can do that. I mean, that's a very, very extreme example. But it's the kind of questions we have because, you know, in our jurisdiction, we have very, very unique circumstances with the kinds of buildings we build. We build different buildings than anywhere else in the state. And we're very concerned that, you know, if you can come up with a rule that can really make a problem, create a problem for us rather than to solve or enhance the solution. That's. I mean, you can pull any number of things out. I mean, but that would be the kind of thing that would concern us.
Mr. Chair, if I could ask one follow-up, please.
Okay, we're going to have to move ahead real quickly here. And I want to state what is probably the obvious, and that is we're not going to get to Senate Bill 430 today. So if you're here for that, we're sorry, but you'll probably need to come back.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
Can I respond to Representative Deckard's question? Probably the largest fear that we would have is this rule writing ability specifically talks about they're going to do an audit of our programs. If they felt that our programs charge too much money for our permit process because of who we pay or how we pay our personnel and provide the service for our community, they could conceivably change the way we do business and require us, and you'll look at what some of the testimony that we provided, there was a provision in the original draft that would require us to reduce our fees to some arbitrary level. That is still a real fear of ours.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Senate Bill 512 requires that the Department of Consumer and Business Services conduct a performance review and financial audit of the local building codes programs. So, I mean, that's like a first step to find out what needs to be changed. And you think somehow, and the board also operates under the direction of this state agency. So I guess my question is, I don't know how they could make sweeping changes because they will be reporting to this department, is my understanding, which is responsible for doing the audits and the performance review.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bowman, those audits already exist. Under previous Senate Bill 35, those audits are now being performed as we speak. Today, one of the local jurisdictions is being audited. Why would we be put into double jeopardy of doing it again just to justify what our expenses are for our program? We adjust our program to pay the fees accordingly and have the customers pay the fees to operate under those requirements.
All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. Next up will be Sean Miller, John Gervais, and John will bring a guest, Jim Backenstoss.
A real life contractor.
Oh, good. ask Sean to speak first. He's got to hit the road here real fast. I promise to be brief.
I appreciate that.
Good to see you leave.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Sean Miller, I represent the Associated Builders and Contractors and the Independent Electrical Contractors of Oregon. We looked at both Senate Bill 512 and the other bill that is in this committee dealing with the intergovernmental agreements. Same issue, that is to make it more consistent from codes, uniform forms, and minor labels, all something that our association supports. When looking at both those bills, we looked at Senate Bill 512 as the answer to our problem. And as for the other bill, the intergovernmental agreements, when our members, our contractors in the Portland area, looked at that particular bill, their problem issue with that bill was, the problem with an intergovernmental agreement is everybody has to agree. And that was one of the problems and why we are here today in supporting 512. As for the practical small business issue in the city of Portland, our contractors do have full-time staff dedicated just to figure out which phone numbers to call at the right times, which forms to fill out, which fax numbers to get the forms into, and run around town making sure that in all 30-plus jurisdictions they're doing the right thing, and in all 17 electrical jurisdictions in the Portland area. That is a problem and has been a hassle for our contractors for quite some time. We believe 512 is a good response. We're not big advocates of bigger government, and we don't view this as a bill that would grow government. And therefore, we do support Senate Bill 512 and be happy to answer any questions at this time.
Thank you.
All right. Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is John Gervain. I'm representing the National Electrical Contractors Association and the Sheet Metal Contractors Association. I just want to clear up a couple of the things, or at least my perspective on a couple of things that have been said today, and then let the contractor talk about how it is on the ground, and perhaps your questions, Tim, will be more meaningful. The situation we in the electrical industry have enjoyed minor labels since the mid-1980s, and Representative Sinceri was helpful in getting that passed. After that was passed, local governments, 20-some-odd in total, refused to adopt the minor label program. Blanket would not use it until the Attorney General came in after a year and said, either you've adopted the minor label program or that activity is not subject to permit and is not subject to inspection. The reason we put in minor labels was to try to, we're running into situations where somebody would ask for a new light switch to be put in their home, and that would cost $38, and a permit would be $45. We created a $10 permit, a sheet of 10 of them, and so that the consumer would be better served, and then the local government only had to inspect 1 out of 10, and then if they felt that contractor was not a legitimate one or they found problems in some of their work, then they could inspect them all, but they couldn't charge more to the individual. We also, in the 1980s, with the help of Representative Sinceri, in the electrical industry only, required that every jurisdiction in the state have a uniform application form. But to get that, we had to use the state law to do it. And that's why we don't have any confidence in the situation of going to governments for agreement. A lot of these things we enjoy in the electrical industry that others don't, because we came to the legislature and made the case years ago. We have contractors, and I'd like to have him talk about it. One point that was made is about the sweeping rule ability. This group can consider rules, but just like under the present situation and present statutes, the administration must be in agreement also. They can't pass them by themselves. And audits of local governments, as was said earlier, was passed in 1995 for all kinds of building inspection activities throughout the state, so that's nothing new for them. We put them in the 80s in the electrical because we had so many problems. I just want to make a couple of those points. I've submitted testimony, and I'd like to elaborate further with you individually, but I think it's more important to hear from a real person.
Thank you. Would you identify yourself?
My name is Jim Backenstoss. I run the service department for Oregon Electric. I've been an electrician for 38 years. My dad was an electrician. He was an electrical inspector. I've been associated with the trade for a long time. I don't want to tell my age. I've dealt with everybody that was up here from the different municipalities, and there is a need. There's need for something in the labels, because we can eat labels if we can't use them in different areas. And I have just in my group 67 service people, and we move around the tri-counties all the time. And we got to buy the labels in blocks. So, I mean, if we take a loss on them, then we got to pass it on to the consumer. As far as the inspectors making their judgment calls on the code is black and white. And we read it as it, we take code classes just like the inspectors do, and we get the same instruction that the inspectors do. And I belong to NECA also, which meets with the inspectors and with each other, and we discuss the code issues and try to hash them out. There is not on-the-line type interpretation of what the code actually is. And to try to talk to an inspector when he's made a decision and to disagree with him, it's cheaper just to go ahead and do it the way he wants it done rather than do it the way that the code says it to be done. And lately it's been practice of a lot of contractors to go ahead and to bump heads with them, as I have done with different municipalities, but it costs money to do it. They have one section that if they can't find it in the code, and you have found it, it's 110-2 or 3 in the very first part of the code, and it's called by the contractors the God Law. And that is if in the inspector's opinion, if he feels it's unsafe, he's going to call it. There's also another first part of that thing that says that if you don't do the work or don't understand the code, don't make an interpretation. I think this bill is necessary. Something is necessary. Something needs to be done, because if you put it in the hands of municipalities, it takes so long for anything to be done, and it's done, it's fragmented. It's done in so many different ways in so many different places that it's useless to us, and it's useless to the people that are having the work done. And we're there to save them money just like you are.
All right. Thank you.
Just a couple, add to his comments. I think if he were to say, he would tell you that he has service trucks that go into 5, 6, 7 jurisdictions in one day, so they have to have the minor labels for all those jurisdictions, and that makes it very difficult and costly. And by saving, and they have notebooks that are 2 inches thick on thick, just on where boundaries are and who to call, and have to provide those to their people. And I have a couple of permit service people that if they get some meaningful relief in this, it'll cut the cost to them and thus to the consumer ultimately, because they have to bid to win.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your time today. Next up will be Tim Irwert and Jane Cummins. Hope I have your name right.
Welcome. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Jane Cummins with the League of Oregon Cities, and I'm going to give you a handout that contains 23 resolutions from the jurisdictions in the Tri-County area, from cities who, as city councils, as bodies, have adopted resolutions opposing the formation of a new state board, but have committed themselves to improve services and consistency by working together through intergovernmental agreement. I will pass these out. I will let Mr. Irwert make some comments, and then I would like to make some more comments.
Thank you.
Chair Wilson and members of the committee, I'm Tim Irwert. I'm city manager for the city of Hillsboro. My connection with building codes is that as assistant city manager and now city manager for the past 20 years, the building division of Hillsboro has been under my jurisdiction. For those of you who aren't very familiar with Hillsboro, currently we have the second largest local government building program in the state, second only to Portland. We do a lot of things, everything from microprocessor fab plants to the person who wants to put a wall in their house somewhere to create a new room. And one of the problems with coming up with a single solution is just that kind of diversity. The fact is that you have builders and contractors who work only in one jurisdiction. You have builders and contractors who work throughout the metropolitan area. And a solution that works for one may not work for the others. Local governments try to tailor their programs for their customers, and in some cases that includes mostly local, and in other cases it includes both local and metro-wide. Local governments serve not only the contractors, they serve homeowners, they serve downtown businesses who do their, who, many of whom try to do their own work rather than using contractors, and our primary objective is to deal with safety and consumer protection. Improving building inspection programs in the Tri-County area is a goal that all of us at the local level also share. We can provide greater consistency, we can enhance services to our customers, we can improve the capabilities of local building department staff. We want to do that, and we want to work together to do that, and the resolutions that you have indicate that. Cities have shown their commitment to work together, and we believe that the better way to do that is through the language of House Bill 2971 rather than Senate Bill 512. The reason is multiple, but 2971 is essentially the local government proposal. It would require local jurisdictions with building inspection programs to be a part of the intergovernmental agreement. It would not be optional. And it would create a local tri-county board with balanced membership. Again, the differences between our solution and the other solution recommended by the task force are not huge, and in fact, there are relatively few things involved. But I think we look at things from a number of standpoints. We oppose establishing a new state board, even at the metropolitan area level, and we particularly are concerned because it's dominated by the trades and the construction industry, which is the industry that is regulated. And while we believe very strongly that the regulated industry needs to have input in this process, and that needs to be strong input, we're concerned about the balance of it as proposed in 512. We oppose, again, the broad rulemaking authority and fee-setting authority, which was talked about before. We're concerned about the expenses. We believe that through the local government process, the local governments can provide some of the resources necessary to meet the need, and that we could do it at less cost overall. We think we can improve the training program within the existing system without the additional cost and without adding a training position specifically for the metropolitan area. And generally, cities do not support developing another layer of administrative building codes. And I think there's more danger that with a metropolitan area board as kind of a subset or that can actually second guess some of the things at the state level, that you get more chance of having two building codes rather than one in the state. We're concerned about that. Now, the main reason that we think that having intergovernmental agreements solve the problem is that, number one, we've seen intergovernmental agreements accomplish great things. We've seen, for example, in the Portland Metropolitan Region, a regional water supply plan that was done by an intergovernmental agreement. And that one was cooperative. Nobody was forced to participate, but 27 water providers, which were districts and cities together, worked together to come up with a plan, common plan. We also think that it's easier to make change in services, in the way that services are provided and in the forms that are used and so on, by involving all of the service providers. And we think the intergovernmental agreement approach would do that, rather than having an outside agency or board mandate down to the local governments how they will provide service. It would allow the local governments a lot more involvement in determining exactly how those changes are going to be made. As was stated earlier, we have cities that don't have computers, and we have cities that have fairly sophisticated computerized systems for their building permits. It will be costly and difficult to coordinate all of those systems together and come up with a common system. It's a lot more likely to happen by consensus of the parties involved and the local governments involved than it is by some outside force trying to mandate how they do it.
And again, Jane Cummins from the League, let me make a few points. It was mentioned that is this another layer of government or is it not, whether it's the IGA or the new board under 512. And I would say that the board under 512 indeed does create another layer in building code administration. We now have a statewide code. It is administered by and adopted, administered by the state, and local governments may assume the administration. What we need to do is to improve basically that system. And the reason I say another layer is going to be established is that you're now going to have the Building Codes Division, and which already has some boards that do some of the interpretations that deal with the adoption and some numbers of the number of the issues. But this new board authority is going to be to oversee local programs. It's a different type of board than the other boards at BCD. And even though the director of DCBS will be asked to give his or her approval, I want to point to you some of the language which indeed does point out what the sweeping rulemaking authority is in this bill. It's been mentioned that BCD already has the authority to audit local programs, and they have put local governments in four different groups, and I believe they're about halfway through the state. But what this Section 8 does, it says that the rules of the board adopted under this section shall supersede any conflicting provision of a building inspection program approved by the department. Now, what this does is it sets up a situation where you have a local operating plan submitted to BCD. BCD approves it, then, and they do an audit. But then you have this other board that is with a membership that we think is not appropriate, being able to override that local plan. And the director, seeing that language in the statute, may very well feel that there is authority to do that. We think it is. It sets up some inconsistency. It sets up some real question as to the rulemaking authority. We do indeed need a more uniformity, and we do have some suggestions on how generally we should be able to get greater consistency and uniformity across the state. And I would say, first of all, we need to start with the Building Codes Division. And I think that there are some suggestions that you heard from the building officials up here, that we do get different calls from the Building Codes Division. Also, the code that we have has become much more complex. We have a lot more provisions, seismic, that are driving some of the contractors crazy. We have energy and we have ADA provisions. We also have provisions that allow for some interpretation and flexibility and alternate methods. It's not a black and white code. It is one that is open to interpretation and flexibility, and that is one of the features that many contractors at the local level have liked. We think that there could be better training, and this is an aspect that we do not need any changes in. We have surcharge dollars now going to BCD. There's no reason why we can't focus some of the training in the Tri-County area, but taking half of the training dollars and sending them to the board, and I'm not sure that I see a lot of strings attached, and then if we create this, seeing as it's a model or a pilot, and we do this around the state, we're going to be divvying up those training dollars and not retaining them at the state to do some statewide trainings.
Just a moment. We've got to adjourn in 2 minutes, so if I can
wrap up. And thirdly, I think we need to get the local programs to work together, and that's exactly what city councils in the Tri-County area have committed themselves to do, to work to make the very same improvements. And I will refer you to a table that was included in the packet, and this is a table which points out the differences between 512 and the local government proposal, and as indicated in our proposal, we would carry out the same responsibilities for far less cost. In that $500,000, which is just an initial cost. There are extra costs for training for a training specialist. There are extra costs to add program reviewers. A lot of that work is already being done at BCD, and we think the costs far outweigh any advantages.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony today.
Thank you.
Sorry, we're going to have to stop here. We will probably be bringing this back again, although a lot of work apparently has to be done here, and I expect that some of the parties involved are going to need to talk about this. I'd like to talk with some of you about it as well. I'd like to introduce into the record written testimony from Clackamas County, AGC, Oregon Columbia Chapter, and Washington. No other businesses before us today. Committee is adjourned.
Oh, I almost...